Jerry.
Well, she tried.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We welcome you to the House Committee on Revenue. Paul Warner is the representative from the Legislative Revenue Office. And our clerk for the day is Christy Bowman. We're thankful to have you here, keeping good track of us. And today we will have a public hearing on House Bill 2195. Let's go ahead and invite Paul to go ahead and tell us what this bill does. Then we will invite to the dais, or up to the witness stand, Carol Reeves from the Board of Accountancy and Alan Steiger.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Chair. The bill you have is House Bill 2195, and you've got four bits of information there in your packet. The first is just the sketched outline of our staff measure summary, which we would complete if the bill goes through the committee. A couple of things to note. One is there is no revenue impact and no fiscal impact. There's a brief description of what the bill does, and then a brief background on what the Oregon Board of Accountancy does. I've also included in your packet just the one-page summary sheet that accompanies the governor's telephone book size budget, recommended budget, and there is a brief description of each of the agencies and boards in there that are part of the budget. And if you look at that, you can see the overall FTE for the board of seven, the budget in terms of other fund revenue, and also just a brief outline of the responsibilities and functions of the board.
Paul, do all the members have a copy? All right.
I think I just found
all of the members have it. Thank you, Paul. Please proceed.
Part of your packet. Mm-hmm. It's under Consumer and Business Services. It's at the top line. That's the program area that it's in under the budget. And then it has the details for the Board of Accountants.
And this is from the governor's recommended budget.
It's from the governor's recommended budget, just to give you the size of the overall budget and overview of responsibilities for the board. The next thing in your packet is a summary sheet on House Bill 2195 that was put together by Carol Reeves and the board. I'll let them go through that with you. It describes some legislative history, and the purpose and the reason behind the proposal of 2195. If you flip on the back side of that, you'll see that there is a House Bill 2195-1. So one side is 2195, the other is -1, and you should have that -1 amendment in your packet. And essentially the -1 amendment revolves around the disclosure policy. Again, I'll let the board describe the issue as they've dealt with that. This was recently drafted by Legislative Council following some comments on the original draft, and so we had that just in time for the meeting.
Thank you very much, Paul. Carol, can we have you and Alan come forward, please?
Thank you.
Enter in. State your name, please.
Now I do. Good afternoon, Chair Butler, members of the committee. My name is Carol Reeves, and I am the administrator for the Board of Accountancy. And I let Mr. Steiger introduce himself.
I'm Alan Steiger, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, and I'm here as an individual CPA.
I am. Thank you. you have before you House Bill 2195, as well as the -1 amendment to 2195. Both iterations of this bill are offered on behalf of the Board of Accountancy. And with your permission, Mr. Chair, I would like to include the -1 amendments in my discussion of House Bill 2195.
Please do, Carol.
Thank you. The -1 amendment to House Bill 2195 does not affect the first two provisions of the original bill. And so I would like to talk about those two provisions first and then concentrate on the portion of House Bill 2195 that is affected by the amendment, if it is all right. The first provision in House Bill 2195 is to establish new authority for the board to issue cease and desist orders. Currently, The board has the authority to take disciplinary action in the form of revocation, suspension, denial of a license, to assess civil penalties, and, of course, we always have the authority to go before a civil court and obtain an injunction when necessary. That, however, is a very expensive remedy and not one that is often used by state agencies. The cease and desist authority, the board believes, will be an additional aid in the regulation of the profession of accountancy because it will address those people who either are judgment-proof and therefore civil penalties do not encourage them in any way, or they may not have a license that is at risk. They might be unlicensed people who are practicing public accountancy, or they may be people who have a lapsed license. And while your license is lapsed, you don't have the right to practice public accountancy. If there's a cease and desist authority, the board can order those people to stop doing whatever the violation is that is in place. And the violation of a cease and desist order is in and of itself grounds to go before a civil court to obtain a preliminary injunction. This authority does not have any fiscal impact either on the board, either through revenues or expenditures. We already have the authority to assess civil penalties, and so it doesn't increase that in any way, nor is it any additional cost to the board because we will be investigating these complaints whether or not we have this authority. We would just be having to resort to our current sanctions. The second portion of 2195 that I'd like to talk to you about is the portion that relates to the inactive status of a license. Most professions offer to their licensees the ability to apply for an active or an inactive license depending on what they're doing at the moment. And the Board of Accountancy is no different. But in our statute, there is the word retired and two other provisions that talk about the eligibility for an inactive license. The board has always interpreted this to mean retired from the practice of public accountancy that would make you eligible then for an inactive license. Because we have many licensees who are in a profession that doesn't require the license. One might be teaching in a university that doesn't require a CPA license. One might do work like Mr. Steiger, work for a private company or a private industry in an accounting function, but they do not require that you have a CPA license. And so long as you are not offering yourself to the public as a CPA, you could have an inactive license. Inactive licensees do not have to maintain the continuing education requirements, and they also pay a lower fee. In our estimation, you don't have to be enjoying your golden years in order to apply for an inactive license. But that is the implication from the statute. So we would like to have the word retired removed to make it very clear to licensees that they can apply for an inactive license if they meet the other two provisions of the statute.
I might interrupt you right there, Carolyn. It might be that the person might even be serving in the legislature and didn't see a need to maintain a license.
And enjoying life while doing so.
And not retired, I'd say.
Absolutely. The board feels that the word retired is not necessary for public protection and that it is confusing and would suggest that it be removed. And finally, we come to the last provision of this bill, which is a little bit more complicated and which is also the subject of the amendment. It has to do with what is called peer review. And you all may have heard of that term. I think perhaps the medical profession uses peer review. Some other professions do. But the Board of Accountancy requires peer review for licensees who perform certain services. And those services are called attest services. The purpose of the peer review is, of course, for public protection. Peer review is a situation where one licensee's work is reviewed by another licensee who is qualified to do the review. The reviewing licensee offers a report back with suggestions for improvements for corrective action. So it is an educational and a corrective process that is ingrained and has been in Oregon as a part of the public accountancy profession since, I believe, 1981. The attest function is the function that one reads about in the newspaper when one hears about failed audit, and there's a lot of noise about damage to the public. Attest services are performed by licensed certified public accountants, in some cases licensed public accountants, and the purpose of them is to assist the people who use financial statements. for example, banks or credit agencies, may require a business to obtain an independent review of their financial statements before the bank decides to issue credit to that business, to make sure the business is creditworthy, that the business itself is a going concern, and there's a good chance that they will be able to repay the money that is being extended to them. On a more widespread note, investors, the investing public, relies on the audited financial statements that are prepared for publicly held companies at the requirement of the SEC when they make their investment decisions every single day. Oftentimes, major clients or customers or suppliers of a business or a partnership will request a review of the financial statements before they enter into a contract with another business. Businesses turn to licensed, certified public accountants to provide these services, and these are the services then that require peer review of that licensee's work. The board feels, and for that matter the profession feels, that the need for public protection is much higher when there is this third-party reliance on services that are performed by the certified public accountants and accountants. Licensees who perform attest services are required to enroll in an approved peer review program. Under the terms of these programs, the peer review reports are confidential, and the licensee who is under review and the peer review program themselves maintain confidentiality between themselves of the peer review report. House Bill 2195 includes a provision that would allow the board to retain the confidentiality of peer review reports. When the board was developing its legislative concepts for this session about 2 years ago, and the board wants to increase its ability to review peer review reports in order to increase its regulation of the profession and maintain greater public protection, the board appointed a task force, a peer review task force, to discuss the issues, to come up with considerations and recommendations for the board. And as a result of this, there was great concern about the fact that these peer review reports that are now confidential would become public when they came in the hands of the board. And so to provide a safeguard, the board developed the legislative concept to perhaps allow these to remain confidential. At the time, there was a great deal of skepticism whether or not such a provision would be approved by the legislature in light of our public records law, but they felt it was necessary in order to obtain full cooperation in developing this process.
Carol, I can appreciate why financial statements are provided on behalf of and are kept confidential. Because they're client financial statements, not necessarily for publication under a SEC requirement, those kinds of things. But I don't know that I've ever seen a peer review report that had anything that was super confidential that talked about specific financial information about any of the clients. So there was some feeling that because it normally doesn't contain that it ought to be. It ought to be public, but now the request is in the amended, the Dash 1 amendments would keep that together with financial statements of our clients, our CPA's clients. It would keep the review report, the peer review report, confidential like financial statements, because they are reviewing financial statements in that process, too. Mm-hmm. Is that the theory?
Yes, Mr. Chair, partially.
Okay.
I think I would agree with you. Peer review reports themselves generally do not have great detail in them. And the underlying financial statements, there's already a provision to maintain confidentiality for those
yes.
in the statute that the board has no interest in publicizing a customer's, a client's business papers or business status. Part of the concern was that the peer reviewers may not be able to do a forthright and candid review of the work if they felt that it was making them an arm of the disciplinary function of the State Board of Accountancy. They don't believe that is their role, and it certainly is not their role, and that is not the role that the board wants. The board simply wants to require licensees to provide these peer review reports to them at each renewal period and within 45 days of the time one is issued. So the concern was that the peer review program itself might be at risk if the peer reviewers did not feel comfortable in providing a candid peer review report. However, in the 2 years that have lapsed, the entire profession and the nation have come a long way in moving toward what is called transparency. And transparency in this context refers to full disclosure of the full gamut of peer review reports and papers. The American Institute of CPAs, Certified Public Accountants, fondly known as the AICPA, and I know you hate acronyms, but this organization is the largest professional organization for certified public accountants. And their new president, a gentleman named Robert Blessing from Seattle, who is with the Moss Adams firm, has recently made a statement to his membership, as his inaugural, that peer review transparency should be accomplished, and AICPA will work with the membership and with the state boards to accomplish that goal.
In that regard, Carol, are there any other states that are requiring public disclosure of peer review reports at present?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure I can answer that directly. Many of the states that require submission of the peer review reports to the board do not have a sunshine law like ours.
Okay.
Oregon has one of the most open sunshine laws in the country. And so those states that do require submission of these reports generally will have some less restrictive or less open public records laws than we do.
I know that you meet frequently, from time to time, periodically, with your other state boards of accountancy, and this is obviously an item for a breakout session. But this has been reviewed with your colleagues and peers and other boards of accountancy, and they obviously are requesting the peer review reports as well. But because they don't have the sunshine laws that we have, they've just always kept them all confidential anyway.
I believe that that's a fair statement in most instances. One also has to be reminded, Mr. Chair, that there are many states in this country that have not yet made peer review a requirement as a part of the licensing process. Oregon is one of the first and was a leader in that regard. There are states that still do not make this requirement.
Thank you, Carol.
So they're not uniform.
Are there questions of Carol before we invite Alan to speak?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Comp is recognized.
I hate to seem uninformed, but I have not a clue what the Sunshine Law is.
Let me just say this is how our county council explained it to me back when I was a wee tot coming into this process.
Okay.
Sunshine disinfects.
Okay.
The more you can put, the more sunshine you can have on your legislative process and the things that we do in the legislative process, and the more that you can go to the Board of Accountancy and have everything transparent, everything visible to the public. In the process that the director has just, the administrator of the Board of Accountancy has just described to us, when they are reviewing the licensees, auditing, if you will, the licensees, they ask for some very specific information, some of which is highly confidential. That's financial statements. We want to see that you're preparing financial statements in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles.
Okay.
In the process, now Oregon requires that each of those accounting firms that prepare audited financial statements and reviewed financial statements are required to have a peer review. That is, they have, and there was another piece of legislation, another committee, I think, that maybe it's this committee, that we're allowing out of state, it's already passed the floor. That's right, I recall now. But in that process, I looked down at where's name Riley.
I have an idea.
I think I remember that. I think I got rolled on that. Excuse me, Representative. We'll talk after. You can take me out behind the barn later if you'd like, Representative. But in that process, the peer review, which now authorizes accountants to be reviewed by other accountants, including out-of-state accountants, firms that specialize in reviewing each other's work, and there's some very high standards to jump through. It's a very high bar to jump through to do that. I won't go there. But in that process, the peer review report then comes back, and this last item, the last of three items that Board of Accountants, the administrator's talking to us about, is whether or not that ought to be public or whether or not that ought to be protected by the confidentiality. And at present, we're going to go ahead today with the Dash 1 amendments to keep that confidential.
No, I'm sorry.
The other way around.
Okay.
We're going to allow that to become a public. The board may disclose, and my information is that if I read from number 5, may also review, and B is the working paper and the peer review report. So what is happening is that we're making the peer review report public.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I beg your pardon. I
that clarified it.
Okay. Boy, Myra really clarified it for you because I had it backward. Because number six kept the financial working papers confidential, and I was lumping 5C in with 6, and I stampede to apologize.
You got it. No, that was very helpful, and I know Representative Olson also appreciated that.
And Representative Berger is recognized.
Mr. Chair, if you'd indulge me, I know this peer review is an important part, but I have a couple questions over the earlier parts of this bill that were, you know, we passed over very quickly, and if you'd indulge me a couple of questions,
please, I would appreciate it. I'll yield the gavel to you.
A quick question on the active-inactive. What's the kind of percentage of active-inactive? And when someone becomes, for instance, inactive and then is no longer required to keep up educational certification requirements, assure me that there's some process for them to go back through. Suppose they got out of the business, went to the legislature, came back, and had missed one or two changes. Is there some way for them to become active through a process that ensures that the public... Do you understand the question?
I do. Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Berger. Thank you for that question. It's an important one. I happen to have our statistics with me.
I thought you might.
I thought you might ask the question. We have a total of... I'm going to just talk about CPAs. We have 2 licensing levels. And of CPAs, we have 5,600 licensed active CPAs, and we have 1,500 inactively licensed CPAs. Then if you look at PAs, we have 48 licensed active and 17 inactive. This is a very small portion of our licensing group. If one chooses to become inactive because the work they are doing does not require that they use their public accounting skills or does not require that they have an active license to do so, they're not required to have continuing education during that period. But at the time they choose to become active again, there are reinstatement requirements. And those requirements vary depending on the period of time that a licensee was not active. If you're inactive for 2 years or less, then you have the usual 80-hour requirement. If you are inactive for 5 years or less, then the CPE or continuing education requirement jumps to 160 hours. And then if you are over 5 years, I think it jumps again, or you may choose to take the exam again. But we've never had anyone tell us that they would like to take the exam again instead of do the continuing education. So, yes, we believe that the public continues to be protected because they cannot be reinstated until they show that they have had current continuing education credits to bring them up to date of what's gone on in their absence. In this field, there are changes.
And I thank you for that. You obviously had anticipated that question, and I appreciate that you did, because we need to get on the record here that there, when we're making this change between active and inactive, it isn't a matter of just changing the name on the books, to inactive. It's a matter of a whole host of education requirements and protections to make sure you are. One other quick question, since the chair indulged me. On the cease and desist, is this something that you, where did this come from? Are other regulatory, or I should say, boards and commissions, do they have this authority? Is this part of sort of a general review? I'm well aware that accountancy has gotten hot in terms of its protection.
function nationwide as a result of events, and is that where this comes from? Is there some need that we're not aware of that this comes out of? A little more information.
Mr. Chair, if I may, Representative Berger and members of the committee, it is not an unusual authority for an agency, at least in the state of Oregon, to have. My experience with other agencies is that it's fairly common. A cease and desist order is probably the lowest level of sanction that a board or an agency might impose upon an individual. In section, paragraph 7 of section 1, it states, if the board has reasonable cause to believe that any person has engaged in, or is engaging in, or may engage in, conduct that is in violation of any of our provisions, then we can go out at that time and stop the activity at that time, immediately, a cease and desist order. Of course, there's always the right to a hearing, so I shouldn't say the word immediately. Mm-hmm. Nothing is ever immediate as the grinds of justice move on. But it allows the board to take an action against someone who has nothing else to risk, an unlicensed person, for example. If we have a licensee who chooses to ignore a board's order that's issued, say, to pay a civil penalty or to take continuing education, the board then can take away their license. Mm-hmm. We can't take away the license of someone who doesn't have a license to start with. Or if it's an individual who doesn't care enough about their license to maintain it in an active status, it's in a lapse status, we can take it away, but it's not as meaningful. Or we can pile on civil penalties to an individual. But if they're a judgment proof, they don't care how many civil penalties we pile on. But a cease and desist order requires that they stop. This conduct is in violation of our rules, and stop, or then we can take you to civil court for an injunction more easily and more less expensively than otherwise.
Please follow.
Does this come out of an increased perception or a factual? Are people running around calling themselves CPAs and or whatever, and becoming? Is it a problem? Does it come out of a problem, or is it preemptive in your mind putting this language in here?
Mr. Chair, I'm Representative Berger. I would say it's a combination of both. The problem is not overwhelming. Mm-hmm. However, one of the most frequent violations that the board does deal with are people who are either using the designation during a period when they're lapsed or inactive, which is against the rules. If one is using that designation, then the expectation of the public is that you are, in fact, current on all your professional competencies. You are in a position where you can provide these services. If you're inactive, you haven't done continuing ed, you may not. You are not competent. If you're lapsed, you certainly haven't been keeping up with your competencies, and you're not competent to provide the services. So that's one type of person. There are other individuals who maybe in a dream one night they took the exam and passed it and became a certified public accountant.
They missed that day?
I'm not sure.
A week or whatever.
But someplace in their life they believed that they became a certified public accountant, and so they start writing this down after their name. And there's nothing in their history that would tell us that they have those skills or that they have been so trained or that they are eligible for that designation. And so the board has been frustrated because we can take up $5,000 penalty after $5,000 penalty, but they're meaningless to a person who has no license at risk and who's already judgment proof. He'll just keep on writing his little name with whatever he wants to write after it. And so out of frustration, probably over the past 3 years, the board has commented on several occasions, we need to have authority to issue a cease and desist order. That would give us a stronger position against this sort of violation.
Thank you for that, and thank you for your indulgence.
Certainly. Representative Estelle.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious. I come from a real estate background, and I do know that people that example, property managers was the biggest one I've ever seen, but it was $40-some thousand fine by the real estate commissioner for practicing property management without the benefit of a license. You don't have that same authority, is what you're saying?
Our authority is to take away the license. They don't have one to start.
These people didn't either.
No. Or to issue a civil penalty against them.
And so what we do is we take an action, we issue an order, we give them an opportunity for a hearing, it may or may not occur, and then a youth-based civil penalty is assessed.
The civil penalty, Carol, as I'm reading it, is on page 4 on lines 16 and 17, mm-hmm. authorizing $5,000 per violation.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. And we may or may never see payment of a civil penalty depending on the person's ability to pay. We file liens against the property owned by folks who owe civil penalties to the Board of Accountancy. And we may collect on those if one day they finally want to sell their property and they have to clear off the lien first, but that doesn't happen very often either. So it is a sort of an omission there that the board felt would be helpful to be able to say to that person, this conduct is in violation of our rules. You may not do that by this order. You know, you shall cease and desist from this conduct. And then if they continue, the violation of that order is in and of itself evidence sufficient to bring a preliminary injunction in civil court. Now, that's more serious. You start taking people to civil court, and they're going to stand up and pay the closer attention than to an administrative hearing.
Yes, Representative Galizio is recognized.
This is a separate, different question, but if the board has reasonable cause to believe that someone is about to engage in any violation, why is that there? What's the? And I'm just trying to.
Mr. Chair
that, yeah.
And Representative Galizio. It is common practice when agencies are going to develop a language in their statute that they haven't had before to look to other statutes in the state that may have a similar provision. And, in fact, that's what this is. This is language that was taken from probably a combination of other state agencies that have cease and desist authority. And I know that this language, for example, is in the statute that provides for securities violations. And there are some activities that you may have reason to believe the person is going to, in this case, make a securities offering. He's taken steps, you've learned of them, and you'd like to stop that violation before the public is damaged. Keep in mind that just because the board or any agency issues a notice proposing this action, the individual still has a right to an administrative hearing. So the individual has a right to come forward and say, but you're wrong. I'm not doing that for the reason you think. I'm doing it because I like to prepare taxes for my grandmother and my great-grandmother and whatever, and may have a perfectly reasonable justification for the conduct, in which case the board's order would not be issued. The administrative hearing on the notice would prove that the board's information was incorrect. But this allows boards and agencies, in this case the Board of Accountancy, to stop conduct and recurring conduct, if it's already occurred, at the earliest possible date to prevent harm to the public, because that is our first goal, is to prevent harm to the public if we can, and if not, to stop recurring harm to the public. So I understand your concern about those words, but I think that I've never seen any actions issue out of speculative conduct.
Yeah, responding to your concerns, Representative.
Yes, thank you
very much. Let's see. Yes, Representative Boquist.
I'm going to follow up where Representative Blazer left off. Can you give us a specific example of where you would know someone is about to engage in a violation? Not securities, but in your case.
I understand. Thank you. Mr. Chair, if I may, and Representative Boquist.
Please.
The closest I can come would be an example of advertising. Perhaps through some untoward circumstance, the board were to come across information that an individual was going to put a full-page ad in the newspaper, public accounting services, taxes half off, all licensed CPAs and PAs, and being loyal and dedicated bureaucrats, we'd go directly to the office and check our database to find out if these people are in fact licensed and learn that they're not. And so the conduct hasn't occurred yet. The advertising has not yet been published. But
well,
we have ample
Carol,
evidence will be.
Just interject right there. Probably one of the biggest areas that I've seen in my my professional background is when a school or other municipal organization starts to let its bids for asking for bids in the community, and you get someone that comes forward and checks the box and says that they're a certified public accountant in the state of Oregon, when you know that they're not. And so they're about to engage in something that's an activity that, and before the bid is let, somebody needs to blow the whistle on that process.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Much better example. I appreciate it. He saved my bacon on that one. Thank you.
Alan, could we have your testimony, please?
I just want to follow up. This is all civil.
This is all administrative hearing, which is different from civil. It's a lower level than civil litigation.
Gosh, I mean, you're describing like you're almost entering into the realm of criminal.
Right.
Or it could be very easily.
Chairman Butler, members of the committee, let me apologize first for the heading on my written testimony. I originally thought this was going to be heard before a different committee. I'm Alan Steiger. I reside at 5185 Southwest 91st Avenue in Portland. I am a licensed CPA, and I have been since 1968. I'm Vice President of Information for ADEC, Inc., a dental equipment manufacturer in Newburgh, Oregon. Past board member, officer, and president of the Oregon Society of CPAs, and a past member and chairman of the Oregon Board of Accountants. I'm a current board member of the American Institute of CPAs, the national organization representing CPAs. I'd like to speak to the amendment to 2195. I do not believe it's in the public's best interest to include a provision for confidentiality relative to peer review reports in ORS Chapter 673. Peer review was originally designed as an educational remedial program to strengthen quality control, prevent recurrences of problems, and correct deficiencies in the practices of member firms. From the beginning, its role was corrective rather than punitive, and members expected confidentiality through the process. In the 1990s, certainly even more so in the aftermath of the highly publicized corporate failures and accounting scandals, the Sarbanes-Oxley Act of 2002, the new corporate and financial reporting requirements, there's increasing public demand for all professions to promote transparency, disclosure, and responsibility. The University of People that relies on peer reviews has greatly expanded and now includes not only CPA firms, but regulators, clients, and many different kinds of credit grantors. All of these constituents expect greater transparency, but will be unable to evaluate peer review reports as long as that information remains confidential. Since 1977, members of the AICPA's Center for Public Company Audit Firms and the AICPA Private Companies Practice Section have made peer review reports available to the public. Firms performing audits of governmental agencies under government auditing standards are required to provide their most recent peer review report and letter of comment to the party requesting and contracting the audit. Other firms disclose the peer review report at the request of a client or as part of their efforts to demonstrate to clients their commitment to quality. Among the peer review firms that perform audits, it's been estimated roughly 11,000 out of 16,000, or almost 70% of those firms, currently make some aspect of their peer review results available outside the firm. The AICPA and NASBA, National Association of State Boards of Accountancy, have both gone on record calling for increased transparency of peer review reports. Greater peer review transparency will reaffirm that CPAs are a profession that does not tolerate those who break the rules, since it would allow regulators, clients, potential clients, and the public to become aware of those who fail to comply with the rules or have practice quality issues. The scope of a peer review depends on a firm's practice. A systems review covers all aspects of the firm's attest practice, and the scope of the review may be expanded based on the findings during the review. An adverse report on a system review reflects wholly incompetent audit procedures. A modified report on a system review results from sloppy practice on multiple engagements that include a number of different problems. There's an overall failure to meet system requirements. An engagement review is limited to a single engagement per partner per level of service. An adverse report on an engagement review reflects an engagement that is performed incompetently with violations of generally accepted accounting principles. A modified report occurs more frequently on an engagement review because the scope of the review is limited to a single engagement and errors on that particular engagement are the sole basis for the report. Given what's reflected in peer review reports, I do not think it's unreasonable to make these available to protect the public's interest. There is a concern among some CPAs that the prospect of greater transparency may cause some peer reviewers to protect a firm from adverse impact on its practice by showing restraint in reports they issue. If this were true, greater transparency would lead to less meaningful reviews. During the quarter of a century that members of the AICPA Private Companies Practice Section and the AICPA Center for Public Audit firms have had public files, there have been tens of thousands of reviews of thousands of firms available for anyone to look at. In all that time, there has been little evidence to suggest that the quality of reviews has suffered. Furthermore, the AICPA Peer Review Board is currently pursuing a system of enhanced oversight to help ensure the diligence of peer reviews, preventing reviewers from turning the other cheek or back scratching. If a peer review report contains negative comments, those comments will be available to a wider audience. Some could argue that litigators or competitors may use this information to the detriment of the firm who received the negative comments. In the history of peer review at the AICPA level, there is no evidence that public peer review information has had an adverse, litigious, or competitive impact. To the contrary, the peer review program has contributed to enhanced performance, with many firms publicizing the results as evidence of their firm's quality. Furthermore, if a firm knows that the results of its peer review will become more widely available, it will likely do everything possible to increase the quality of practice to ensure a positive review. It is true that transparency of peer review information could enable regulators, potential clients, and the public to penalize firms that receive a peer review report containing negative comments. It will be up to those firms to embrace the important remedial aspect of peer review, allowing firms to improve based on peer review feedback. In addition, firms that receive negative comments will need to manage the expectations of clients and prospective clients who have access to this information, sharing their plans for enhancing the quality of their practice. Many CPAs, and I am among them, believe that transparency is consistent with the profession's core values. We feel that moving to increased transparency is a natural evolution of the profession, which is founded on the public's trust. Transparency in peer review is seen as a demonstration of the CPA's professional recognition of public concerns and a commitment to hold itself to ever higher standards. Greater transparency will increase the public's confidence in the CPA's core values of competence, integrity, and objectivity. As a board member of the AICPA, I support transparency of peer review reports from the profession's core values. As a former member of the Oregon Board of Accountancy, I support transparency of peer review reports to permit the board to accomplish its mission of protecting the public interest. As a member of the Oregon Society of CPAs, I support transparency of peer review reports to enhance the quality of accounting and auditing performed by Oregon CPA firms. As a CPA in business, I support transparency of peer review reports to assure that the services that I am receiving from a CPA firm have been delivered under a quality system that has passed muster from an independent reviewer. As a CPA, I support transparency of peer review reports, as poor quality accounting and auditing reflects adversely on me, my profession, my standing in the community, and my perceived value to my employer. As an individual and an investor, I support transparency of peer review reports so that I can rely on the work performed by the CPA firm whose opinion I'm relying upon to invest funds for my and my family's financial well-being and retirement. Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you very much, Mr. Steiger. Are there questions of Mr. Steiger? Very well done. Thank you very kindly. We also have Senator Saram that's offering testimony. Come forward, please, Senator. I believe you're the past president of the Oregon Society.
That's correct. No.
Of the
actually. Mr. Chair, and I'd like to first say that I may not follow this exactly because I've forgotten my glasses.
That's fine.
And Representative Berger, the accounting couldn't be that hot. At the moment. Good afternoon, Chair Butler and members of the committee. My name is Sandra Sorand, and I am a practicing CPA. I am not a practicing CPA, or either CPA firm or, thank you, that helps, or industry. I work as a private management consultant. I'd like to speak to you from three perspectives, both from within the profession, both the regulatory side and the advocacy side. And I think that distinction is also important. I have served as my comrade Alan has on both sides. I have also served as national chair of the Association of Boards of Accountancy, as well as on the Society or Advocacy Board of Directors. As I also am speaking as an advocate of small business, which I've done throughout my career. As that, I was Oregon's first small business advocate and drafted the statute setting up small business programs for the state. I was the national small business advocate. I also co-chaired the Advisory Council on Small Business and Agriculture for the 12th Federal Reserve District, which includes Oregon. From all these perspectives, it is in the best interest of both the profession and certainly of small business for the public to know the quality or lack of quality of CPA firms. I've been asked to give you a little bit of the history of peer review and quality review in Oregon, but I'll attempt to make it succinct and as less dry as possible. The first quality review program was begun in Oregon in 1978, and I assisted in drafting the statute, which still exists pretty much intact. At that time, the purpose for it was to increase the accountability and to increase the accountability of CPAs in the public view, and also to make the public aware of the fact that there was someone protecting the performance of their financial statement reviewers. At that time, or when it was first started, it was all volunteer. We could only do it with publicly accessible financial statements. That's through the Division of Audits, the Corporation Division, and the Department of Justice. So accomplishing that process at the time only gave us access to about 50% of the profession, and we determined that was not fair, nor was it actually accomplishing our responsibilities to the public. So based upon the program that we had developed, the enabling statute was passed in 1981, and it enabled the state board to budget funding to hire and compensate peer reviewers, quality reviewers, directly from the state board. The statute exists in basically the same format today. The purpose for which that statute was passed was to protect the public and to provide confidence that financial statements, which are at the core of our financial system, accurately reflect the financial situation that they describe. Because CPAs have a valuable franchise, the public has a right to know whether they are doing an acceptable and reasonable job. For the first 4 years of the program by the State Board, the program was mostly educational in order to give time to the practitioners to become aware that they would be subject to review and of what that review would encompass, and also to enable them to learn from the reviewers comments and to correct their deficiencies. Then the board began taking stronger action against firms that did not improve their quality or in which their work was so broadly deficient that there was serious risk of harm to users of financial statements. They began requiring additional education, additional quality reviews, requiring restrictions on practice, perhaps not to include audits, suspensions of the right to practice, and they began publicly posting major disciplinary actions. In the mid to late 1980s, the legislature began cutting back on regulation and on budgets. The accountancy board at that time lost much of its independent budget capability, even though the board has had and still has the ability to be self-sufficient through its license fees and other sources. The board had to give up its investigative review and administrative personnel related to quality reviews, and that occurred in somewhere between 1990 and 1992. The Oregon Society of CPAs took over the review process, and the board lost access to the reports and to the review process. The balance, what to me is an essential balance between the regulatory side and the advocacy side of the profession, on both sides of which I've served, was lost at that time. At the level currently that peer or quality reviews are functioning now, I should have added, the system does not adequately protect the public, at least not to the extent that it did previously. The greatest problem is that the process no longer operates in the sunshine. The Board of Accountancy is moving to regain that visibility and responsibility for the quality reviews of CPA firms and PA firms. It has the power to do so under the current statute, which was the original statute. Requiring confidentiality will take Oregon backwards. Other states are moving, and the national process, as Alan described, is towards transparency. Although Oregon is ahead of most states, it led, and in fact it was the first state in the country to develop these quality reviews, and it has been ahead, but other states are seeking to accomplish the same things. And I have comments that I have heard from many of the states that they are trying to accomplish that. So this requiring of confidentiality will take Oregon backward, and this would continue a situation in which users, primarily small businesses and small governmental entities that don't have the resources to really investigate and to become aware of the quality of CPA firms, are not being protected adequately by the state-regulated licensing process that's supposed to protect them. As an advocate for the needs of small businesses and as a lifelong promoter of the accounting profession, both the regulatory and advocacy sides, and I believe in the balance, and the balance is critical, I support the need for greater transparency and for not including the confidentiality requirements. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Other questions for Ms. Ryan? Thank you very much. Further questions? No, I've tried to mislead you as to what this portion does relative to the peer review. I found out where I was misreading that incidentally, but that having been said, nothing new. Thank you very much. We appreciate that. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2195, and we'll open a work session on House Bill 2195. Representative Berger now moves the -1 amendments. Is there any discussion or opposition to the -1 amendments? Hearing and seeing none, we will append the -1 amendments to 2195, which now becomes 2195. Further discussion now relative to House Bill 2195 as appended with -1 amendments.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Boquist is recognized.
Well, I support the bill. I'm still slightly confused on the need and the appropriateness of just sticking in an SEC type clause in that says we'll engage in, or we anticipate they're going to engage in the future. I mean, trying to figure out whether or not they will engage in something is kind of a witch hunt. And I understand, Mr. Chair, your explanation, but once they've checked the block that says I'm a CPA, that's fraud. And so well, it's common language. Having been, you know, a small business operator, I have concerns about any agency that is out looking for something that hasn't happened yet. But I still support the bill.
Thank you very much. That's an excellent discussion. Representative Berger.
I would just like to comment that I think it is unfortunate that this room is not full. Believe me, we heard a lot about accountancy a couple of years ago and have been impacted, I think, as a state by sort of inadequacies in this whole arena. And I hope that by acting in this manner, we won't see further of that kind of problems. It's a fact of our system that you come into an empty room and do something and prevent a full room later. And I certainly hope that that's what we're about here this morning, and no one will appreciate it, us for this, or your coming forward and saying transparency is what we need in our profession, but I appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative. Further discussion relative to the work session on 2195 as -1 amended. Are there any objections to the passage to the full House of House Bill 2195 as amended with the -1 amendments? Hearing and seeing no objections, we will now move House Bill 2195 with -1 amendments to the House of Representatives with due pass recommendation. And with that, Representative Riley, you did such a great job on the last Board of Accountancy bill, Public Accountancy and Peer Review.
You know, I didn't carry that. That's someone else, but that's okay.
Okay.
You've got me confused again.
Oh, okay. I beg your pardon. Actually, I was going to have Representative Comp carry it, but Representative Riley, would you like to carry that for us?
I'd be happy to.
Fine. Any further discussion relative to that? We'll close the public hearing then on 2195-1, and we will adjourn until tomorrow at 1:30. Thank you.